Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey.
What is up, you guys? Welcome to another edition of the Fundamental Health Podcast. I am so stoked that you are here with me. And I am so stoked that 2020 is almost over and very hopeful for 2021. I can't tell you how excited I am that things are changing. And I hope that you will all join us at Heart and Soil for the 30-day animal-based reset starting January 1st. I know everybody's thinking about how to get a better body in 2021, how to crush it more in 2021. We want you to join our tribe at heartandsoil.co. and join us for the 30-day animal-based reset. You'll be getting emails from me, all sorts of details about how to eat an animal-based diet. There will be a giveaway at the end of the month for free supplements and free copy of my book. You can find all that at heartandsoil.co with information on how to sign up. If you need more no-tail nutrition in your life, and who doesn't? Let's face it, we all do. If you want to incorporate more no-tail nutrition in your life, check us out at Heart and Soil. We're making these grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised, desiccated organ supplements. We've got bone marrow and liver back in stock. We've got beef organs coming very soon. We've got gut and digestion back in stock. We've got Firestarter. We've got Heart of the Warrior, which is my favorite, heart and liver together. And we've got Immunimilk, which is super immune-boosting colostrum from grass-fed cows right now. We're just super excited to be getting some of our favorites, bone marrow and liver and gut and digestion, back in stock. You know what would be a fantastic gut stack? It would be gut and digestion, Firestarter, and Immunimilk. Those will be amazing for healing the gut for so many reasons. You can check us out at heartandsoil.co. Thanks for being a part of the tribe. Thank you for being a part of the Remembering. I love you all. Join us for the 30-day animal-based reset in January. All right. On to part two of the podcast. I'm so stoked James could be here for this one. Part one was last week. We discussed the role of animals in pandemics, the importance of regenerative agriculture, sunlight, fresh air, what worsens COVID outcomes, who should get the vaccine. And in this episode, we talk about how to create metabolic health. I share a really cool article about linoleic acid worsening oxidative stress in humans. Talk about atherosclerosis, monogenic insulin resistance, Dunnegan familial lipodystrophy. We talk about hormesis. We talk about colostrum, what James thinks of colostrum, compare it with a flu vaccine, and what nutrients are required for robust immunity. We even get into fructose. So enjoy this podcast with James DiNicolantonio. Go back to last week if you want to find part two. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave me a review on iTunes. It's how we spread the word to good people. And I will be giving away a free copy of my book every month to someone that leaves me a review on iTunes. Thank you also to my sponsors. I want to give a shout out to Let's Get Checked. You guys know about them. They are at trylgc.com/carnivoremd. Testosterone is tanking in humans right now for both men and women. Healthy sperm counts are declining. You should get your hormones checked. And what's awesome about Let's Get Checked is that you can do this from the comfort of your own home. You can choose your own test. It'll be delivered to you in discreet packaging within the next day delivery. You can get HSCRP. You can get your hormones, which include testosterone, SHBG, prolactin, estrogen, free androgen index. This is important for both men and women. You can get your lipids checked. You can get your fatty acid levels checked. Once your results are available, they'll be reviewed by a physician. A nurse contacts you for a consultation over the phone to review it. They're CLIA approved, which is the highest level of lab accreditation. All data is anonymized. And the test lets you know what's going on inside. You can take control of your life, change your diet, get more organs in, make dietary changes, do all things. This isn't just for men in a funk. It's for all men and women who want to know their HSCRP, their hormones, etc. You can get 20% off with my code CarnivoreMD. You guys know how to spell it. CarnivoreMD at trylgc.com. That's trylgc.com/CarnivoreMD. Or you can put CarnivoreMD in the checkout as the code. I've done it. I thought it was super easy. It's great. You can do it at home. And I think that getting checked is going to help you understand what's going on. If you don't have a doctor who's going to order this for you, they make it so easy. So check out trylgc.com/carnivoremd. You won't regret it. It'll really help you guys to make changes in your life that are more positive, that'll change your life. Join us for the 30-day animal-based reset at Heart and Soil. Get organs, get your hormones tested, get your other inflammation markers tested. It'll be a good thing for you guys. trylgc.com/carnivoremd. All right. And I want to thank White Oak Pastures, whiteoakpastures.com. Grass-fed, grass-finished meats, regeneratively raised in the heart of Georgia. The grass there is so green. The cows are so healthy. The meat is out of this world. Give them a call. Use the code CarnivoreMD at checkout for 10% off. Let them know what you want to get. They have organs, grass-fed steaks, all sorts of lamb, chickens that are soy and corn-free. Those are special on the website. They did that just for us and our listeners. Check it out. And by supporting them, you are really helping regenerative agriculture move forward, which is how we change the world. Check them out, whiteoakpastures.com. Use the code CarnivoreMD for 10% off your first order. And Belcampo.com, love these folks. Northern California, also doing regenerative agriculture, grass-fed, grass-finished organic meat. You can use my code CarnivoreMD for 10% off, and actually for 20% off your order, or use Carnivore10 in addition to any other promotion they have going on, and you'll get 30% off your order. I love the Bavette steaks. I love the Flatiron steaks. They have amazing ribeyes. They have liver. They have heart. They have suet. They have so many good things. Check them out, belcampo.com. Again, White Oak Pastures and Belcampo are fighting the good fight, you guys. Please support them and increase the health of your family by giving them organs and these meats and the future generations that depend on the quality of the soil on this planet. Blue Blocks is our last sponsor for this week's BLUBLOX, blueblocks.com. I love them. I'm wearing their blue blocking glasses right now. I like the Jasper. They've also got a sleep mask. They've got a red light device called the Hive, which is amazing. And they have these light bulbs you can put in your house, which are red light bulbs, BLUBLOX.com. You can use CarnivoreMD for 15% off your order at Blue Blocks. If you don't have blue blocking glasses, you need them for like airports, airplanes, friends and family, when it's nighttime and there's white lights on or blue lights on that are affecting your circadian rhythm. These guys are amazing. They've done the work to really make what I believe are the most technically advanced blue blocking glasses that block all the wavelengths that are going to really mess up your circadian rhythm. And they look cool. Like I said, I have the Jasper. Makes me look like a hipster. I got them on right now. Check them out, blueblocks.com, CarnivoreMD for that. All right, guys, on to the podcast with James DeNicolantonio. Listen after for what is going on with me. So let's just take a quick detour, because I know people listening to this are going to ask this question. And it's something that really is at the heart of what I'm doing these days. Let's talk about how you think humans become insulin resistant, aka metabolically dysfunctional. I like the latter term better, for a variety of reasons. And let's just outline for people how to not be metabolically unhealthy, how to not be insulin resistant. But let's just take a quick detour to go there. People that have listened to my material in the past will know this answer like the back of their hand. But I want to make sure we just give people this takeaway, because fundamentally, this is the most important part of the podcast. Right. And maybe the discussion of the nutrients that will come next. But you know, what can you do about it? Well, the first thing that both James and I would say is go outside and go in the sun, right? If it's winter, still go outside and go in the sun and maybe supplement with vitamin D, and don't be metabolically unhealthy. Don't be insulin resistant. So how do we get there in your opinion, and how do we fix it? And then I'll add my perspective.
Sure. So I guess the two main dietary drivers of insulin resistance would be refined sugars, okay, which are much worse than even starch or let's say honey, which actually raw organic honey has actually shown to sometimes improve insulin sensitivity.
That's interesting, right?
Because it's actually considered a whole food in a complex of, you know, numerous phytonutrients, minerals, fiber, you know, so the spike in sugar is much less too. And then obviously omega-6 seed oil. So most of this is being driven through inflammation. So why added sugars cause more insulin resistance than even, let's say, flour is because when our cells metabolize fructose, it produces oxidative stress. And that's what leads to insulin resistance primarily is through oxidative stress. And same thing with seed oils. Seed oils are tremendously oxidative, you know, stress load on the body. And what I like to say is an adipocyte that is loaded with omega-6 and lacking omega-3 is an inflammatory fat cell. And macrophages then start becoming recruited into the adipocyte, and they start then producing and secreting their own pro-inflammatory cytokines, right? And that then starts leading to systemic insulin resistance as well. And so I think a lot of this is being driven through refined sugars and refined omega-6 seed oils.
So before the podcast, you and I were talking about another podcast I had heard. The participants of the podcast will remain anonymous. But it was another very well-respected physician talking to a diabetologist and endocrinologist about insulin resistance. And a lot of the things they were talking about were quite fascinating to me. They talked about things that I've talked about in this podcast before, the increase in free fatty acids driving peripheral muscle insulin resistance, and then leading to liver insulin resistance. And we can talk about how visceral fat plays into all of this. But the biggest disappointment I had in that podcast, and I hope my path crosses with this podcaster here in Austin very soon so that I can bend his ear about this, was that this preeminent diabetologist just brushes off the fact that the diet can change this. And they did this really interesting research on Stanford undergraduates, or maybe it was Yale undergraduates, who were sedentary. And they found that a lot of them had impaired postprandial glucose disposal. They had some level of the beginnings of, quote, insulin resistance, aka metabolic dysfunction, as essentially non-obese but sedentary Yale undergraduates. And what they found in these individuals was that their free fatty acids were high. The non-esterified free fatty acids in the blood were high, and that was driving the insulin resistance, quote unquote, at the level of the muscle. But this preeminent diabetologist just, in my opinion, just stopped short of the goal. It's like he ran a marathon and he stopped, you know, right, half a mile before the finish line. He never asks in the podcast, and the host never asks in the podcast, why are the fatty acids high in these individuals? Why are the non-esterified fatty acids high? Instead, this really well-known endocrinologist goes on to say, well, you know, we both know, talking to the podcast host, that patients won't do dietary change. Therefore, we have to use pharmaceuticals. And, you know, this was so disappointing to me because I think that if they'd just gone one more step, they would have arrived at something very fascinating, which is the idea of why are free fatty acids elevated in the blood? And that really, to me, drives it right back to the level of the adipocyte, which is where I've sort of been suggesting and talking to people like Peter from Hyperlipid and many others on this podcast over the last few months about where does insulin resistance start? Where does metabolic dysfunction start? And they kind of skipped over the adipocyte. I mean, they talked about it a little bit, but I think it really starts at the level of the fat cell, as you're suggesting. And so if you guys are curious about this, go back and listen to the first two podcasts that I did, or the two podcasts that I did with Peter from Hyperlipid. I think this ties it all together very well. I did one with Brad Marshall from the Croissant Diet as well. But if we think about metabolic dysfunction arising at the level of the fat cell, then that's where essentially, I mean, nobody would debate, that's where the free fatty acids are coming from. We say, well, why is the fat cell releasing the free fatty acids? And I think it's because people are exceeding their personal fat threshold, or there is some inflammatory response in the fat cell, predominantly driven by excess omega-6 seed oils, linoleic acid, that is causing them to release those free fatty acids. So you talk about this a little bit in your book. Do you want to talk about the personal fat threshold and its connection with visceral adipose tissue?
Yeah, I do think there's certain people where their personal fat threshold is much lower. So if you look at typically at like Asian Indians who are thin, they actually have a lower fat threshold. And so they start storing visceral fat very quickly. Whereas a typical American, they start gaining a lot of sub-Q fat first and have a higher personal fat threshold before they start storing visceral fat. And so you sort of see these two different phenotypes, right? You see someone who is thin on the outside, fat on the inside, or someone who is fat on the inside and on the outside. And so I think there's definitely a play between both inflammation in the fat cell, too much storing of fat, right? You've reached your threshold and it's ballooned up, and also too, lack of muscle and activating the muscle, because your muscle is your largest pool for soaking up glucose. So I think there's a combination of a lot of those things going on.
Yeah. And so when James says sub-Q, he means subcutaneous fat. Right. This is the fat you can pinch around your belly. Visceral adipose is intraperitoneal, around the organs and the, in the abdominal cavity. So I'm going to talk about lipodystrophy in a moment here, but I think that the most compelling hypothesis that I've been able to put together is that it does appear. And if you listen to the podcast with now Tucker Goodrich, with the first one with Chris Kenobi, the one with Peter from Hyperlipid, the one with Brad Marshall from the Croissant Diet, I got a lot out there for you guys. You'll see we're always talking about the potentially negative effects of excess omega-6 seed oils at the level of the adipocyte. And this is really Peter's idea that excess omega-6 seed oils hold the door open to the adipocyte, creating inappropriate insulin sensitivity, which allows them to take on more and more fat. So I do wonder if at the level of the fat cell, you can get to a level where you can actually either lower your personal fat threshold or get there faster by eating excess omega-6 seed oils. Because essentially what we see in these patients is they see these free fatty acids spewing out and then affecting the muscle cell and kind of signaling to the muscle cell, hey, you should be insulin resistant. Now, this is an evolutionary system whereby we would employ this mechanism during times of fasting, right? This is how we stay alive when we're fasting, is that the fat cells actually do release free fatty acids. And that does signal the muscle cell, hey, become insulin resistant physiologically to spare glucose for the rest of the body. But I think we're inducing that inappropriately with these evolutionarily inconsistent omega-6 fatty acids. The other thing you mentioned is the inflammatory and oxidative stress piece. I don't know if you've seen this paper, James, but it's one of the coolest ones I've come across recently. So many of these studies with linoleic acid don't show any increase in oxidative stress. But this is a cool group of researchers in Sweden that put people on 8 weeks of a saturated fat diet, 38 volunteers, 4 weeks, sorry, of a saturated fat high diet. So they kind of give them a saturated fat baseline. Then they switch them to a high linoleic acid diet or a high oleic acid diet. And what they found was that when they switched them from a diet rich in saturated fat to a diet with increased linoleic acid, that there were increased oxidative stress markers, 8-iso-PGF-2-alpha, and there were decreased urinary concentration of nitric acid metabolites, which is a bad thing. You want nitric oxide in your body. That's a real marker of endothelial function. But I thought that was so cool that if they didn't take somebody on the standard American diet, if they took somebody on a saturated fat-rich diet and then switched them to linoleic acid, they saw all of these things. They saw increased oxidative stress, decreased nitric oxide, like you were talking about, problematic things.
Right. Well, yeah. So essentially, how oxidative stress reduces nitric oxide is through the production of superoxide anions, which will combine with nitric oxide and reduce nitric oxide levels to form the harmful and toxic peroxynitrite. Essentially, how high intakes of omega-6 seed oils, you know, reduces nitric oxide is through oxidative stress. So there's an increase in superoxide anions, which will combine with nitric oxide to form the toxic peroxynitrite. And thereby you are both promoting oxidative stress and reducing nitric oxide levels. So it's interesting, you know, I've had people say, well, how can getting off omega-6 seed oils actually help my blood pressure? It's because a reduction in oxidative stress improves your nitric oxide bioavailability.
Yeah, certainly one of those ways. And I think that there's some interesting mechanisms by which systemic metabolic dysfunction later on could worsen blood pressure too at other levels. And then, so let's just talk about, before we move on from that, I just want to show people this paper, which is amazing. Just so people are aware of this condition. So this is Dunnigan familial lipodystrophy, which is fascinating. And what's interesting to me about this is that it's a monogenic form of insulin resistance that doesn't have elevated LDL that leads to premature atherosclerosis. So in the future, I'm going to do a whole friendly debate with Spencer on LDL and whether it directly causes atherosclerosis. But in my opinion, this condition itself is a really fascinating thing. So these are people with a mutation in LMNA. And again, it's a single gene that creates insulin resistance. But what happens in people with lipodystrophy, as you mentioned earlier, is they cannot store fat in the subcutaneous tissue. So they store it all in the visceral adipose tissue. These people are they have ripped calves and legs, and they have a real big belly because they have a whole bunch of fat on the visceral adipose. And so what's fascinating about this is they get insulin resistant because those subcutaneous adipose tissues and probably the visceral adipose tissues are releasing increased levels of free fatty acids. And that is causing insulin resistance in the muscles. And they're getting, and this is another paper showing the same thing, they're getting elevated CRP. So they're getting inflammation like we talked about. They're getting lower leptin and adiponectin levels, and they're getting premature atherosclerosis without elevated LDL. So I think that's fascinating that you don't even need elevated LDL to get accelerated atherosclerosis if you have insulin resistance driven by an exceeding, driven by, you know, moving past the ceiling of your personal fat threshold in this situation of a genetic mutation causing an inability to store fat in the subcutaneous adipose. I think that's such a fascinating thing. And then they store it all in the visceral adipose. And as people may know, the visceral adipose is the vasculature goes straight to the liver through the portal vein. So that's going to be a problematic thing too. And I believe these people do develop non-alcoholic fatty liver because they're going to get free fatty acids increased in the portal vein. And also all these inflammatory mediators going through the portal vein straight to the liver. So that's fascinating. Anything you want to say about that? I wanted to ask you about fructose next.
Well, yeah, so I can piggyback off of that. So we published a paper on how we think added fructose drives visceral fat. And you don't even have to reach your personal fat threshold if you overconsume fructose because it can produce an increased cortisol, which will directly increase the formation of visceral fat. So through the oxidative stress as well. And then what's interesting too is fructose, if you overconsume it, it will increase the endogenous conversion of glucose to fructose, causing further damage, which is just kind of crazy to think about, that actually glucose becomes more harmful if you're consuming fructose through this, you know, polyol aldose reductase type of pathway.
Now, what do you think is a reasonable amount of fructose? Is it fructose outside of fruit? We talked a little about honey and whether that's any different. From your perspective, how much fructose can the body handle? Because it seems that our ancestors ate some, right? Seasonal fruit. They probably didn't eat it in excess. And they definitely, you know, honey's not available year round. There's not a ton of honey available very often. And they certainly didn't have constant everyday access to big gulps. So where do you think that the seesaw starts to tip here?
I think we should invent a new term called the personal fructose tolerance.
Maybe, yeah, right.
Because it's going to be different for everyone. But essentially, if you have more muscle and you're activating your muscle more, you're going to certainly have a higher fructose tolerance. But it will really depend primarily if it's coming from refined versus whole food fructose, because there's a huge difference. And even from a COVID perspective. So there were over 300 COVID patients that they gave 1 ounce of raw honey twice a day with about 5.6 grams of black cumin seeds. And the individuals who got the honey plus the black cumin, and this is a preprint, so it hasn't been published yet, so we got to still wait till it actually gets fully published. But there was an 82% reduction in mortality in severe COVID patients. And it was a 14% absolute reduction. So essentially, the placebo group, almost 20% of those died, whereas only 4% who got the honey and the black cumin died. It was a huge reduction. I mean, when you think of statins, when they talk about a 50% reduction in mortality, they're like taking a 2% absolute risk of mortality and maybe cutting it down to 1%. We're talking like 18.8% versus 4%. So a huge absolute reduction in mortality. And it cleared, you know, people cleared the virus about 4 days quicker with this honey and black cumin. And also, you know, the duration of the virus was anywhere from 3 to 7 days shorter. Again, it's a preprint, but it was in 313 COVID patients, which is that's a lot of COVID patients.
It's really interesting. I wonder I guess they were just looking at the molecules in honey and whether that had some benefit. And presumably there's a molecule in black cumin that they thought could be antiviral in some way.
Yes, it's exactly correct. And a lot of those substances too are native to Pakistan, which is where the trial was performed. And so I contacted the research authors too, and I asked them, well, what type of honey was this and what type of black cumin seed? And they said it was just natural raw honey, a non-branded form. And it was partially ground, you know, like your natural black cumin seeds. And so to get back to your question of how much fructose should we be having, I think fructose, if it's coming from blueberries or coming from honey, is not nearly as bad as if it's coming from a refined crystal or high fructose corn syrup. And I would say, I mean, I personally will consume 3 ounces of blueberries, no problem. And one to maybe even 2 ounces of honey for several weeks, no issues. And I think you've even done a glucose test on yourself, and you're pretty insulin sensitive, even consuming fairly high amounts of raw honey.
Yeah, I did a very long N of one experiment with my continuous glucose monitor from NutriSense. I was eating probably at least 100 grams of carbohydrates from honey a day for probably 2 to 3 months. And I did a number of carbohydrate experiments over the last few months that people can hear about on my social media. And yeah, I mean, you could see on my blood sugars on a CGM that in the morning it would spike a little bit, maybe to 120. If I had honey in the evening, it would spike a little higher. I think it's pretty clear humans don't have quite the same degree of glucose disposal in the evening as they do in the morning. Right. But when I took my blood sugar, it was low. Fasting blood sugar was low. You could see the glucose variability was very low. And my fasting insulin was less than 3, and my C-peptide was like 4.45. Like 0.45. They were like really, really low. Like people would look at that and say, you have type 1 diabetes. Your fasting insulin is so low. So clearly 2 to 3 months of 100 plus grams of honey did nothing to my insulin sensitivity. And this is why I think that metrics that are solely based upon glycemic response are poor, right? Because you could get a glycemic response from 80 to 120, and people in the keto community might get their pantalones in a bunch about that. But clearly I think that's normal human physiology and it's fine. And yet at the same time, many people in the ketogenic community or other people in the medical community would say, well, you can eat whatever you want as long as you keep your blood sugar low. And this kind of irks me too, because I've heard other people in the medical community say, yeah, I'm so proud of myself. I had potatoes and a steak and a dessert, and I had 25 milligrams of acarbose, which is an alpha glucosidase inhibitor in the gut, and my blood sugar stayed low. And I'm thinking, what the heck? Like, why are we trying to, you know? And another person was saying, oh, I'm so proud of myself. I had waffles with almond butter and, you know, they had allulose in them and my blood sugar didn't even move. And I'm thinking, this is the worst metric in the world. None of those, you know, this person that was eating steak and potatoes and dessert had more micronutrients than the person eating waffles. But the waffles guy with almonds had no micronutrients in there, which I want to get to next. And so just saying to someone, you know, this is a really well-known, respected doctor just saying to Jocko in a podcast, you can eat whatever you want as long as it keeps your blood sugar low. To me, that makes no sense. And it's wrong on both counts, because some things will raise your blood sugar a little bit. You can probably eat a handful of blueberries. It'll raise your blood sugar. I don't think it's bad for humans. And there are a lot of things you could eat that won't raise your blood sugar with fake sugar alcohols like allulose, or you can take acarbose. And there's no micronutrients in there. So this is just a really poor metric. And I encourage people to look beyond the dogmatism of pure, you know, glucose response, beyond to like a full postprandial glucose response. How long does your glucose stay elevated? What's your glycemic variability? You can use a CGM for this, but it's more complex than just postprandial, you know, how high does it go in an absolute sense. I want to know what the AUC is under the curve. And anyway, that's a whole separate issue that we won't go down there.
I love that. I love that you kind of mentioned that, because it is so, so very much nuanced. And just because something doesn't spike your blood sugar level doesn't mean it's healthy. And you bring up the great point of, you know, those artificial sweeteners, which may not do that, but are damaging to the gut microbiota or induce inflammation in an organ where you need to absorb these nutrients. I did want to ask you a question. How many grams of carbohydrates do you typically consume in a day now?
So it's variable, right? And I always hesitate to discuss this, because whenever I say anything, people always want to do what I do, or they want to criticize what I do, right? So right now I probably consume 75 to 85 grams of carbohydrates in a day right now. And this is just kind of my meanderings, right? I did white rice. It was just kind of like, okay, you know, I did fruit. I didn't really feel good with fruit. I got a little more gas. I felt a little bloated. I didn't feel satiated. I didn't feel like my energy was stable. Even though that's an ancestrally consistent food, it didn't seem to work for me. The lectins in squash trigger my eczema, apparently. Sweet potatoes made me burp. So I tried all of what I could think of as like the most ancestrally consistent sources of carbohydrates because I wanted to put them back in my diet.
Yeah.
And I came back to honey. And so here I am with like a couple of tablespoons of honey in the morning and that's it. And I don't do any carbs at night. It seems to be good. I don't have cramping in my muscles. I don't have palpitations. I get some carbohydrates and my workouts are great. And yet I don't think over consuming carbohydrates. So that's what I've landed on at this point. What are your thoughts on that?
That's great. I love it. And I think, do you personally feel a little bit better adding some carbohydrate to your diet?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. Like, you know, but that's not to say that ketogenic diets aren't helpful for people. And I've been very clear about this, that in people with pre-existing insulin resistance or metabolic dysfunction, I think lowering carbohydrates lower than where I am is going to be very helpful in the short term because you're just not going to tolerate honey. Like, I don't think honey is for everyone, but right. I think honey from the right sources could be a really enjoyable addition to people's diets who are active, who are metabolically healthy. But honey is not for a diabetic, whether you're right. type 1 or type 2. Like, you got to fix that and get to normal glycemia before you add honey. And I think that a lower carbohydrate diet than what I'm doing would be better for a type 1 or type 2 diabetic for sure. So I'm not denying the importance of low carbohydrate interventions, but for me, someone that's healthy and active, the inclusion of carbohydrates was a really important sort of tweak in my animal-based diet that improved things a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. So like I just feel mentally better, physically better when I work out. And like you said, you and I have a fair amount of muscle. We're both lean. And so, you know, I probably consume anywhere from 100 to 150 grams of whole food carbs. Like, I love green bananas. I'll have raw honey too. And, you know, I'm not afraid to eat a few slices of Ezekiel bread, which is just sprouted organic, you know, grains. It's totally different than your typical whole grain in the United States. And I feel so much better consuming that 100 to 150 grams of carbs per day. And there's a lot of evidence for why that is the case. And, you know, the reason why a lot of people feel better on that 100 to 150 grams of carbs per day and why you feel probably better at 75, 85 is, yes, your body can make glucose, but if you eat the glucose, then it doesn't have to waste energy creating it. And honestly, it's as simple as that. And a lot of people will tell you that, yes, at first, totally dropping to, let's say, 20 grams of carbs or maybe not even anything was really good initially, but then things started sort of not going well. And when they started adding maybe 100 grams of whole food carbs back, once they fixed their insulin resistance, they just felt a whole lot better.
Yeah, I love it. And I think that's kind of the magic number, 80 to 100. I mean, I've heard people say 90 grams, like you should give your body 90 grams of carbs a day. Like that's, but who knows? It's probably somewhere in that range. Yeah. So you're going to make it if you don't eat it. And right. I think for some people, getting rid of it is a good thing short term, but long-term, I think the dogma gets in the way of a lot of people doing as well as they could. So,
well, that's it. What's interesting too, Paul, is like, we used to get, like when we would consume like whale skin and the intestines and stuff, we would get all these type of, you know, polysaccharide sugars, right, as well. And so when you consume true nose to tail, I mean, even the liver.
Oh yeah. The liver has carbs.
The liver, right? It's like a 400 gram carb bomb. So we would definitely get animal sourced carbohydrates, so to speak.
Yeah. And testicles are high in carbohydrates. Probably nobody listening to this eats it, but I do. And when I can get them, and those have carbs because the sperm need the carbohydrates. And so they're kind of sweet. And yeah, a lot of livers will taste sweet, and it's a moderate amount of carbohydrates in liver, but we shouldn't fear the macronutrient group in and of itself.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the nutrients that help the immune system go. So at a nutrient level, what kind of things do we need to be getting in our food? And of course, we know that if you're eating animal-based whole foods, you're going to be getting these nutrients, but let's highlight some of these nutrients that are really foundational for the immune system.
So I guess if you go structurally, if you go to physical barriers like mucous membranes, epithelial, endothelial barriers, then vitamin D, vitamin A, and riboflavin are your three key stars for your physical barriers, tight junctions, things like that, right? So, you know, and viruses and bacteria have to get through mucous membranes and physical barriers first in order to even infect you. So if you have a poor vitamin D, vitamin A, riboflavin, you're probably at a much higher risk of the virus actually getting into your cell and infecting you.
Yeah. And those, I'm thinking, whenever I think riboflavin, I think about organs, because heart and liver, such a good source of riboflavin. Riboflavin is like my favorite B vitamin because, you know, all methylation works with that. MTHFR has allosteric control with riboflavin apparently. And so I see so often when people aren't getting their organs or getting, you know, riboflavin rich foods that they don't methylate well, their homocysteine goes up, et cetera. And so, and the vitamin A is the same thing. It's like that's in animal foods predominantly, and at least in the most bioavailable form. And that's, I suspect that there's a lot of subclinical vitamin A deficiency in the world.
Oh, tremendously.
Because you'd have to eat so much sweet potato to get enough beta carotene to be converted, and nobody eats liver anymore. So,
yeah. I mean, well, pasteurized H2 is a great source for riboflavin, and even glutathione reductase, right? If you want to reduce oxidized glutathione, you need riboflavin too. So it's a hugely important nutrient that at least, oh my gosh, probably 50% of vegetarians are probably deficient in.
Oh, got to be more than that. I know you talk about zinc, right, in the book. Zinc.
Yeah. Yep.
So what is zinc doing in the immune system? That's a real big one these days.
Yeah. Zinc forms copper zinc superoxide dismutase, which helps us handle, you know, oxidative stress in the body. And zinc also helps control DNA repair enzymes. So if you think of like a COVID long hauler, you got to repair that DNA. Well, that requires zinc, a tremendous amount of zinc. So zinc is involved in about 300 different types of enzymes. And we know, I mean, zinc probably has one of the best evidence in regards to if you get a cold or an upper respiratory tract infection and you take zinc within the first 24 hours, you dose it correctly, you take it every 2 hours, you need about 18 milligrams of ionic zinc if you're using a lozenge, and you have to get over 75 milligrams of zinc total per day for this to work. But you can almost eliminate the entire duration of a common cold if you do that type of regimen.
And I mean, I think just like magnesium, just like vitamin A, just like riboflavin, the majority of the population is low in zinc because they're not eating whole foods, animal exactly. foods. I mean, yeah.
They're not testing carnivores or animal-based people with the zinc. You probably don't even need it, you know, to do that. If you're consuming, you know, 1 to 2 pounds of meat per day, you're going to get 40 to 80 milligrams of zinc per day anyway. And so you know what I mean? These supplements probably are almost useless for people like us that are consuming good amounts of zinc.
I've got to imagine that. Now, I just want to put a caveat here for people. Consuming zinc supplements without copper can lead to ruin because you can become copper deficient. The body balances all these things. And evolutionarily, I don't think we would have consumed zinc without copper because we would have consumed liver or other sources of copper in our environment. And the zinc in our diet will protect against copper excess. People will sometimes say, will I get copper, you know, toxicity by eating liver? And my answer is no, because both copper and zinc are going to end up in a metallothionein protein in the small intestine. But if you only eat zinc, like I've heard multiple case studies and case reports of this, people eating 50 to 100 milligrams of zinc per day in a supplement, and then their testosterone tanks, and they say, what's wrong? Or they get problems because they get copper deficient. And I think copper is another nutrient that I would talk about for people that is important for the immune system. Also part of zinc, copper, superoxide dismutase that people often don't get unless they're eating organs. I mean, it's in other things too, but organs are such a good, unique source of the copper. So,
So beef liver has a copper to zinc ratio of about 0.36. So it's actually higher in copper to zinc. And you're right. It's a great source of balancing the two out, because there are clinical studies that if you just take zinc at 40 to 50 milligrams per day without copper, you tank your copper zinc superoxide dismutase, which is a marker of copper levels in the body, because it, you know, that depends on copper. So you definitely always, if you're taking a copper supplement, at the very minimum, the golden rule is 40 milligrams of zinc and 1 milligram of copper.
You got to have it. And then recently when I was thinking about our histamine stuff, you know, DAO, diamine oxidase, is a copper dependent enzyme. So if you take a bunch of zinc, you don't get enough copper, that enzyme is not going to function well either. So it just kind of comes back. What's so interesting for me about eating nose to tail, or at least eating, you know, whole foods, animal based, is you're going to get these nutrients if you just get these organs in. And if you just eat the muscle meat, you could get deficient in them. Glycine is another one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's in the connective tissue for glutathione. Those are the big ones. There was one that I saw in your book that I wanted to talk about because I'm kind of excited about colostrum these days. We just released an ImmunoMilk supplement at Heart and Soil, which is a grass-fed colostrum, and that was lactoferrin. Can you tell me a little bit about lactoferrin?
Yeah. So colostrum, right? Yes, it does have lactoferrin in there, which is obviously immune stimulating, super important for the immune system. There's been a bunch of studies that lactoferrin has antiviral effects. And about 35% of colostrum is IgG. It's primarily IgG. And then there's a little bit of IgA and IgM as well. So you're getting these immunoglobulins in colostrum. And there have been studies as low as 400 milligrams of freeze-dried colostrum that have shown that it's potentially even just as good, if not better, right, than vaccinations against certain viral infections.
Yeah, I mean, these studies are striking. And anytime I think you start comparing a supplement, quote unquote, or a food to a vaccination, it's like a little dicey, but right. I'll show these on the screen. We'll put them in the show notes. This is an epidemiologic study in San Valentino, prevention of influenza episodes with colostrum compared with vaccination in healthy and high risk cardiovascular subjects. So this is super fascinating. It was a 2-month trial comparing oral colostrum and the prevention of flu with an anti-influenza vaccine. And in both of these studies, colostrum performed as well or better than a vaccination. And so, you know, obviously this podcast is another one, prevention of flu episodes with colostrum. And this one is with Bifivir. So this one did have a probiotic with it compared with vaccination. This is an epidemiologic registry study. You can see the abstract here, but I'll put both of these in the show notes. But, you know, I think for people to make this, it's going to be an individual choice what you do, but clearly colostrum has immunologic effects, and it probably will be a better choice for people who don't want to get a flu vaccine or who want to augment a flu vaccination. You know, it's something I would even consider giving to my parents now in this winter season. They're going to get vaccinated for flu vaccination, they're for flu, they're going to get vaccinated for COVID, but could something like a colostrum enhance that? It's very possible. And you know, like you said, even at doses of 400 milligrams, which is a very small dose, it's been shown to be effective. So that's really interesting. In terms of other things that you might recommend for people, we've talked about kind of this animal-based diet. In the immunity fix, you kind of have a pyramid, and it looks a lot. I like it, man. There's meat and organs at the bottom. It's kind of an animal-based pyramid.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up and we talk about some lifestyle stuff, I want to talk to you a little bit about environmental hormesis and hot and cold, and maybe a little bit of time-restricted feeding. Anything else you would recommend people consider in addition to what we've talked about so far?
What's really interesting is there was a case series publication of 10 COVID pneumonia patients, and they gave these people high dose melatonin 4 times a day, essentially 10 to 20 milligrams of melatonin 4 times a day. And, you know, essentially the duration of COVID was 5 days less compared to similar COVID patients being hospitalized at the same time. None of them required mechanical ventilation or died, yet similar COVID patients had anywhere from 20 to 40% of those individuals ending up on mechanical ventilation and dying. And so while a case series of 10 COVID pneumonia patients isn't definitive, it really was very, in my opinion, hypothesis generating that high dose melatonin throughout the day, which is an NRF2 activator on a transcription level. So very few molecules can actually increase the transcription of NRF2. As you know, most of them are inhibiting the inhibitor, KEAP1, and just activating your current NRF2 levels, whereas melatonin can actually increase the transcription of NRF2, which is obviously going to provide these huge overall boosts in your antioxidant defense enzymes. And that's ultimately how hormesis works too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what's funny, James, is that I did a podcast with Ben Lynch a number of months ago, and we talked about the use of glutathione in COVID, and we talked about this ratio. There was actually a small case series of the 4 patients that I talked about in that podcast, looking at the reduced to oxidized glutathione ratio. And, you know, basically a lot of the interventions that you talk about in your book that could be helpful when someone has COVID are supporting antioxidant defense, right? So you want to make sure, I think like we've talked about, that you have the nutrients to do that, zinc and copper and riboflavin and glycine for glutathione. And you can use things like melatonin, maybe something in black cumin seeds will produce, you know, will inhibit KEAP1 and affect NRF2. But at the same time, you could also give someone glutathione, which is a pretty safe intervention in the setting of COVID. That video got taken down by YouTube so fast. It was censored so fast for something super safe. And so I'm thinking to myself, you know, I appreciate all this discussion so much and what you're adding here, because I think that there are things that can be helpful for people on a day-to-day basis to keep them healthy. And there are other things and even compounds within the plant kingdom that could be helpful for humans when they're sick with something. They're not necessarily foods that we have to eat every day, but honey and black cumin seeds, that's cool. I didn't know about that. You know, heaven forbid, you know, my parents or your parents or somebody we know gets sick with bad COVID. What are we going to recommend? You know, what are we going to, you know, what are we going to say to them? Say they're convalescing at home and in a hospital. And we're like, well, why don't you try some raw organic honey and black cumin seeds? Like, I would recommend that to my parents, or maybe try some melatonin, or, you know, maybe you do want to try some, you know, S-acetyl glutathione or something to support it, or, you know, other interventions that could support. Now, I think the basis is be metabolically healthy with all the things we've talked about, get out in the sun, but these other interventions are cool. And you go through a bunch of those more in the book that I think could be helpful if people have COVID and they're trying to convalesce or recover from it. And if you're traveling, put some salt water in your nose.
Right. Well, I love that concept that you just brought up. And that is the fact that humans, from an evolutionary perspective, have always known that plants are more of like a medicine, right? They weren't using it for nutrition per se, but if they got sick, right, they might use a little bit acutely.
Yeah.
And so I love that you're open to that idea.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm going to Africa in February, and there's all sorts of herbs, or not herbs, but, you know, plants that might be used if they think they have a parasite, right? Or wormwood or whatever, but they're not going to take it every day. But if they get an infection, I was talking to the woman who's going to come on the podcast soon, Mary Ruddock. She's going to talk about her experiences in Africa, but she was saying that in the bush, they'll take this plant and rub it between their hands, and it makes this kind of sudsy mixture. They'll rub on their legs to prevent snakes, to like ward off the snakes. And I thought, so smart. You know, we've used plants. It's not that I don't think plants have any value in human culture. I just think that the use of plants in the setting of sickness is unique from the use of plants in the setting of everyday nutrition. And that's something I've been pretty clear about in the past. And the former situation is a fascinating one, and there's all sorts of compounds that can be helpful in that situation. And I would never hesitate to even recommend something to my parents that was plant-based if they were sick with something else. Now, am I going to recommend that to them every day? Depends on the situation, but if people are sick. Let's move on as we wrap up. At the beginning of the podcast, I was like, I don't want to go too long, but it's such a fascinating conversation with you. Let's talk a little bit about heat and cold, because I love doing sauna and cold plunge, and I post about it every time because it gets eyeballs. I guess people like to see me putting my body and cringing as I go into the ice. But you have a whole chapter in your book about what I would call environmental hormesis, this hot and cold. Talk to us a little bit about how that's beneficial, because that's the question I always get. People are like, is that really good for you? And why would that be good for you to do sauna or cold plunge or any of these other things?
So there's actually a really interesting story on how they figured out that heating the body is beneficial against pathogens. So in the 70s, a lot of scientists would take both warm-blooded and cold-blooded animals, and they would essentially throw them in a sauna and heat shock them and then give them a lethal pathogen. And when they heat shock them, their survival and their lung damage was so much, you know, better, right? If they were heat shocked. And what's really cool is that it works both in warm-blooded and cold-blooded animals. So if you externally raise a cold-blooded animal's body to a warmer temperature, they are more resilient to a pathogen. And what that goes to show you in warm-blooded animals, at least, is that there is this release. It's mimicking a fever, essentially. Okay. So if you go into a sauna several times a week, you are boosting heat shock proteins. And essentially, you are at those heat shock proteins are increased for 48 hours. So people who go into a sauna several times a week have about a 50% higher baseline heat shock protein level. And so that is why it is almost more of like, I can't say this definitively prevents anything, but how heat shock proteins work is they're not just these protein chaperones that prevent breakdowns of proteins. How a virus has to replicate is the viral ribonuclear protein complex has to export out of the cell in order for it to replicate. And there's a protein called M1 protein that has to dock onto that in order for it to be exported. Heat shock proteins 1370 can actually dock onto that viral ribonuclear protein complex and prevent M1 protein from actually docking onto the complex and prevent its export. So that's the nitty-gritty scientific way on how mimicking a fever with sauna has antiviral benefits.
And what about cold plunge? Because it feels really good to jump in something cold afterwards.
Yeah. I'm a little critical of doing cold right after heat because the benefit, right, of you're sort of giving your body an easy way out and you're cooling yourself off. So let the heat shock proteins activate and do their work. And I tried not to do any type of cold for at least 30 minutes to an hour after a sauna.
Interesting. Have you seen research regarding the benefits of cold exposure?
Yeah, I mean, certainly cold exposure has been shown to activate brown fat, right? Improve insulin sensitivity. There's a little bit, in my opinion, more negatives to cold versus heat. And heat has more evidence than cold, but that's not to say that cold isn't beneficial. But if you do have an infection, the last thing you want to be is cold. You want to be hot. Yeah.
I just like, there's something for me and I should go down the rabbit hole and look at it. It's very calming. I find it very centering and it gets you a little high if you do sauna and then you jump in like a super cold plunge. And so usually people have all different regimens, right? There's all this lore like, oh, you want to end on cold, or maybe I should be ending on hot. So I should do hot, cold, hot. So I get the heat shock proteins. But I do think they're both examples of environmental hormesis. In the carnivore code, I talk about cold exposure, and it does induce NRF2, which is another fascinating thing. It will create some oxidative stress, and so that's probably one of the benefits. But I mean, I don't know if you've ever done like a quick cold plunge after a sauna. It will abrogate the heat shock proteins, maybe somewhat. But man, it feels so. It's just so you come out and you kind of feel high. I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's addicting. I love the contrast therapy.
I don't think it's bad. In fact, if I were to do it, my gut instinct would be that you're probably going to get the most benefits if you actually do cold first and then hot.
Yeah. See, the cold first would be, that's like Wim Hof. That's pain, man. But maybe that would be the thing. Do the cold, fight the cold, and then get warm. But going back and forth feels good somehow. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And then let's wrap up with a short discussion of time-restricted feeding, because I know that there's some cool stuff coming out about this. Generally, what I have found that works best for me is to eat breakfast and then an early dinner/late lunch. And then I'm done for the day and I'll eat two meals a day. So I'll just intrinsically I'm not even trying to do time-restricted feeding. But when I was on Rogan's podcast, he asked me a little bit about this. My knowledge, honestly, of time-restricted feeding and autophagy is not that deep, but I caught some flack for it. I think that there are people out there who don't believe that the evidence is convincing that time-restricted feeding can improve autophagy. But I know you wrote the book with Siim Land, who's talked a lot about autophagy, and wonder if you can offer anything about this. You know, have you seen convincing evidence that time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting, even on a 24-hour basis could improve autophagy? Do you have to do it longer? What are your thoughts on this?
So I think some of the best evidence that we have for fasting and time-restricted eating improving autophagy would be in cancer. So essentially, if you fast for 48 to 72 hours before you get chemotherapy, there are many studies showing that there is improved outcomes and a reduction in chemo side effects. And so that's probably through autophagy. So for humans, really clinically, if you want to start getting the benefits of autophagy, it's probably 2 to 3 days of a fast.
So you got to really commit to it.
You got to get a little deeper than just your typical, 18-hour intermittent fast, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So maybe that's an argument that some of us should be doing 2 to 3 day fasts a couple times a year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does make sense to do a 2 or 3 day fast if you're healthy enough to do that, maybe 3-4 times a year.
Yeah. And you can imagine that's something our ancestors would have experienced. Now, my time-restricted feeding on a daily basis is really just about sleep for me. And the fact that I feel like if I eat earlier in the day, I don't have anything in my stomach, I sleep better. Whether or not that's giving me any benefits from an autophagy perspective is questionable. I'll have to ask Siim about that more. And at what point, it's just so hard to measure autophagy in humans, but you know, I've not done a ton of those 2 to 3 day fasts, and maybe it's something I should incorporate more often into my diet and see how it goes. But that's interesting that that's kind of the cutoff point. So, and there was some, you know, there was a lot of criticism for time restricted feeding or intermittent fasting because a study came out saying, it didn't even help with weight loss. It was the same, you know, and ultimately if I eat the same amount of calories in a 6 or 8 hour window, does that improve things? Hard to say. I mean, there was a bunch of work by Sachin Panda and others suggesting that at least in rats or mice and rodent studies, it was very beneficial, but they have a different biological clock. And, you know, an 18 hour fast in a rodent's like a 2 to 3 day fast in a human.
Yeah. I think that study failed because I think they only did 16 to 18 hours where you really start getting more deeper fat burning at the 24 hour mark. So if you eat a one meal per day, that is, I guarantee you that's going to be your typical diet, but most time-restricted eating studies don't do a single meal per day, 23-hour fast. It's typically only 16 to 18. That's really not enough to get into the deeper fat burning. You really need to reach that 23-hour mark typically, and right, you'll see a lot more fat burning. So it does depend on how much you time-restrict. But I love that you're, this is the hardest part, I think, in such an underlooked aspect of diet, is it's so easy to skip breakfast, but you probably should eat breakfast and lunch and have a really light, if not even skip dinner. But it's harder for people to do. But like a lot of the reflux issues and you're so much more insulin resistant later at night, it makes so much more sense to eat breakfast and lunch versus lunch and dinner.
I agree. But everybody wants to like not eat, you know, they want to do no breakfast. They just want to do coffee with, you know, some kind of oil in it, which is fine. But like, you should just eat breakfast, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And not eat dinner. But socially, people then ask me, well, how do you go out to dinner? And it's like, well, I have to make an exception that day and I'll eat late. But I just don't go out to dinner that much because why would I go to dinner when I have amazing meat in my freezer from Belcampo and White Oak or Force of Nature, any of these places. So yeah, that's interesting. So maybe I'm going to start incorporating some 2 to 3 day fasts and I'll keep you posted on that. So, well, thank you so much, man. This has been an awesome conversation. Anything you want to get in before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
I think we honestly covered it all.
Nice.
Yeah.
And where can people find more of your stuff? Where can they find the Immunity Fix if they want to check this out?
Yeah. So the Immunity Fix is on Amazon, or they can go to my website, drjamesdenek.com, or Twitter, Instagram at drjamesdenek.
Awesome. And I just want to say that I've so appreciated all of your thoughts and collegial interactions and everything you've helped me with over the years. I still think about you all the time because the salt question comes up over and over and over. But as I'm going to Africa, I'm going to keep asking people about it. You know, I was talking to Mary, who's coming on the podcast, and she said that in the south part of Africa, you know this, but I didn't know this, the Kung San and some of the other Bushmen will follow animals to salt licks. And I thought that was really cool. But then she said in Northern Africa that some of them don't even really think about salt. So it seems individual, but I know there are a lot of plants where people can get salt because I keep coming back to salt because, man, I freaking love it. Like I feel better when I have salt. I like salt. And I just want to make sure I'm just trying to understand where ancestors would have gotten it. So to hear that humans were following animals to salt licks is fascinating. And when I talked to Eric Ed Meads earlier in the podcast a few weeks ago, he was telling me that the Hadza don't have salt that he was aware of. I'll ask them when I go to Tanzania, but when they're given salt, they relish it. It's not like they say, get this out of here. We don't want this. So they appreciate it when they get it. So I wonder about that.
Yeah, no, our ancient ancestors would absolutely seek out salt licks. They would follow salt trails. They would eat brackish or salt or drink brackish or salty water. And we primarily would get, I mean, there's a full 1.5 teaspoons of salt per liter of blood, right? And so we're typically told to consume less than 1 teaspoon, but you can, I mean, the Maasai bleed their cattle and they drink a ton of milk, which is actually salty as well. And they're consuming probably 4,000 milligrams of sodium per day, easy. So you get it through blood, you get it through interstitial fluids, you get it in organs, and you can literally get salt just by eating it from a salt lick.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe if I get down to South Africa or Botswana, I'll be able to actually eat salt from a salt lick. But just in case I can't, I'm bringing salt to Africa with me.
There you go. That's a smart choice.
I am. All right, brother. What's the most radical thing you've done recently?
Oh my gosh. Let's see. Radical? I would say probably getting a clear light sauna in my basement. So cool. I can do that 3 times a week, you know.
Nice.
But I've had it for a while, but you know, it's probably the coolest thing that I could say that I'm doing.
Yeah, I've been trying to get a sauna myself. I'll keep you guys posted when I get one, because I miss that too. Well, thanks for coming on, man. I look forward to talking with you soon.
Yeah, you too, Paul. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. That was a good one to James. I know a lot of you guys really dug the first part. Hope you liked the second part. I felt like we were really able to finish the conversation there, which is what you do in the second part of a podcast, I suppose. We were really able to tie a bow on that and make it quite a comprehensive discussion of immunity, which is such an important topic for all of us in the midst of COVID and other viruses right now. So how do you get your metabolic health back? In my opinion, you remove excess calories, which could be processed sugars. You got to get rid of the seed oils, and you got to get nutrients. And where do those nutrients come from? Well, they come from whole foods. Whole animal foods, I think, are the preferred source of those, especially whole plant foods. Excuse me, whole animal foods. That was a brain fart if I ever had one. Whole plant foods are the ones you want to eliminate, at least the most toxic ones. But whole animal foods are the ones you want to get in your diet. That's why we do what we do at Hardened Soil. And you can get organs there, hardenedsoil.co. Like I said, bone marrow and liver is back in stock. Beef organs coming very soon. Colostrum is there. We talked about colostrum in this podcast. It's probably as good or better than the flu vaccination. How crazy is that? That's incredible. And we've also got gut and digestion back. The combination of Immunomilk and gut and digestion is going to be an incredibly powerful tool for healing your gut and really improving overall health and vitality. I got an email this morning, guys, from somebody in India. It was so cool. These emails really are moving to me. He said, my daughter had all these issues. I tried a carnivore diet for her and all of her issues are gone. And that's just so amazing that these animal-based diets are healing people. They're so nutrient-rich. By getting the organs, we're getting nutrients that are changing lives, and eliminating the most toxic plant foods makes it so good for people with autoimmune disease. You don't have to eliminate all plant foods, like I've talked about. Some plant foods are more toxic than others, but the least toxic plant foods are really, really versatile, and they can be in your diet. The most toxic plant foods are probably not worth having in there. They're just too dangerous. They're not worth, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, guys. Eliminate those, and so many people feel way better, and then we're improving people's lives with both the inclusion of organs and meats and these elimination of these plant foods that are causing autoimmunity or damaging the gut in so many ways for people. So exciting things. Pass this podcast on to your friends and family who may have questions about immunity, how to optimize immunity, all these kind of things, who may have questions about COVID, who may have questions about the vaccine. Please let people know about Hardened Soil if you have friends and family who aren't willing to eat fresh organs, who want to get more organs in their life. Check us out at hardenedsoil.co. And you can always email me, Dr. Paul at drpaulhardenedsoil.co, if you have questions about which supplements might be right for you or how to construct a no-sale carnivore diet. I really believe that doing this work is something that I want to do for the rest of my life. It feels very meaningful. The whole tribe here at Hardened Soil finds it to be meaningful. It's incredible to be able to help you guys construct your diets. And it's so cool to always see your stories of improvement. It really helps me believe that we are doing the right things. And that's not so surprising, because this is the way our ancestors have been eating for millions of years. Please support this podcast by leaving me a review at Apple Podcasts. Like I said, I'm giving away a free signed copy of my book to a lucky listener every month for people who leave me reviews at Apple Podcasts. And you all have my undying gratitude in addition, even if you don't get a copy of my book. So please check out my sponsors, hardenedsoil.co, whiteoakpastures.com, let's get checked, trylgc.com/carnivoremd, belcampo.com, and blueblocks.com, or as I said in the intro, blueblocks, whatever I said, blueblocks.com, blueblox.com. All of those use the code CarnivoreMD for a discount in things that I think will make your lives better. All right, guys, please send me your emails. Let me know how things are going for you. Get excited. Join us for Nose to Tail January, which is actually what we're calling a 30-day animal-based reset. You can find that at hardenedsoil.co. We are going to crush it in 2021. I love you all. Talk to you guys soon. Hope to hear from you via email. I can't wait to get more organs in my life. I'm going to go eat some organs right now. Let me know how you're doing in your lives. And 2021, here we go. Happy New Year, guys.